Sometimes when it rains, it pours. Sometimes when it pours, it floods. Sometimes when it floods, it backs up the old storm drain that runs under your driveway and bursts it and wants to collapse your driveway and ruin all the new sewage work that's just been done at your house. That was our experience this Saturday morning. As we were trying to enjoy a little bit of vacation in Rockford, we got a call from the neighbors. Don't want to alarm you, but I think you got a problem over there. And so we threw everything in the car, came home to survey the damage, and yep, we got a problem. And fingers crossed, knock on wood, prayers please, that the city will accept responsibility for their utilities that have to be repaired, which is going to require a great deal of work on our properties, mine and our neighbors as well. But you ever feel that way? Like, man, it's just, you think you're making a little bit of progress with something and then, boom, something else hits you? Now, arguably, sewage issue and property damage and stuff like that in the grand scheme of things is inconsequential. But maybe you feel that way with some spiritual matters that you're struggling with, or maybe with a temptation, or with a relationship, or you know, some circumstance in your life, and you just feel like, man, I cannot catch a break, right? Just feel like it just keeps coming wave after wave after wave, and you don't know what to do. Maybe you even feel like you are all alone, like you've been abandoned. Have you ever thought to yourself, as you've gone through struggles in life, have you ever thought, God, where are you? I know you're out there, but I don't feel you in my life right now. I don't feel or see you working. Where are you, man? Have you ever felt that way? Maybe you cried out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. As Jesus did on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? What's interesting about that is that though that indeed, undeniably, is words that Jesus uttered on the cross, and perhaps arguably one could make the case that in that moment, as he is bearing the weight of the world's sin on his shoulders and paying the price for each and every one of us, that maybe for a second he did feel alone. But when he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? We need to understand that he's not accusing God of actually abandoning him there on the cross. In fact, what Jesus is doing is quoting from Psalm 22, which is indeed a psalm of David, who, if you know anything about the life and the history of that man, he went through some really bad stuff. Yeah, we remember him being chosen as a young man and anointed by Samuel to be the next king. We remember the story of him defeating Goliath in battle, becoming a great warrior. But then he went through many years where he was an outlaw, where he was hunted down by King Saul, who saw him as a threat to the throne. And David went through a lot of really bad stuff in his life. A lot of it that we would look at and we'd say, that's not his fault. He's being mistreated by other people. And I don't know what particular experience it was in David's life that inspired him or prompted him to pen Psalm 22. But turn there with me and just notice the words of this psalm, which Jesus centuries later will quote as he's hanging on the cross, bearing the burden of our sin. The psalm begins, my God, why have you forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I have no rest. The psalmist, David, begins here by saying, God, where are you? I feel alone in all the things that I'm suffering and enduring. I'm crying out to you for help, God, but you're not responding. Where are you? But even as he cries out in desperation, he reminds himself of some realities that he knows. Yet you are holy, verse 3. O you who are enthroned upon the praises of Israel, in you our fathers trusted. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were delivered. In you they trusted and were not disappointed. David says, I can think back to the history of my forefathers. And yeah, life wasn't always easy for them. They went through some pretty bad stuff. But I can see one thing that's consistent. When they cried out to you, God, you answered. You didn't turn a deaf ear. You responded and you delivered. But then he has a moment of self-doubt. But what am I? A worm, not a man. A reproach of men and despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. They separate their lip. They wag their head saying, commit yourself to the Lord, yet let him deliver him. Let him rescue him because he delights in him. Now, what's really interesting about that is unknowingly, the chief priests and the Pharisees would cite that same verse in reference to Jesus on the cross. If he trusts in God, let God deliver him if God delights in him. They themselves were quoting from Psalm 22. David is saying, this is what people are saying about me. Yet you, verse 9, are he who brought me forth from the womb. You made me trust when upon my mother's breast. Upon you I was cast from birth. You have been my God from my mother's womb. All my life I look back, God, and you've always been there for me. You've always been there for me. But right now, in this moment, with this circumstance that I'm facing, I feel like I am alone. Be not far from me, for trouble is near. For there's none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and a roaring lion. I'm poured out like water and my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It's melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue cleaves to my jaw and you lay me in the dust of death. For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierce my hands and my feet. Is that not prophetic about what Christ is going to experience on the cross? I count all my bones. They look, they stare at me, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Why do you think Jesus would have quoted Psalm 22 on the cross? Jesus is looking at what's happening to him and he's saying, this is exactly what David wrote about. Wake up, everybody, and pay attention. Remember Psalm 22? It's happening right in front of your eyes. Which is why I tend to think that Jesus didn't actually feel forsaken on the cross. Now, from an earthly perspective, from a human perspective, we would look at what he was going to, and we wouldn't cast any shade on him if he indeed felt like he had been abandoned by God. But the reason why I don't think that Jesus really even feels abandoned is because of what comes next. But you, O Lord, be not far off. O you, my help, hasten to my assistance. Deliver my soul from the sword, my only life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the wild oxen. You answer me. I will tell of your name to my brethren. In the midst of the assembly, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him. All you descendants of Israel, for he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. Nor has he hidden his face from him. But when he cried to him for help, he heard. When Jesus cried out to God, God did not turn a deaf ear to him. God did not, as one of our songs say, turn his face away and refuse to look upon his son as he suffered on the cross. He heard him. He answered him.
and he was with them. But from all outward perspectives, it seemed like Jesus was alone. I'm confident that Christ was not abandoned by God on the cross. Not only because of what is said here in verses 22 through 24 of Psalm 22, the very psalm that Jesus is referencing in his words on the cross, but notice this text in 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 21 beginning, it says, "For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. And while suffering, he uttered no threats, but did what? He kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness, for by his wound you were healed." You ever thought about how did Jesus find the strength to endure the cross? How was he able to not just go through the physical pain and anguish of a Roman crucifixion, but in that same process, and by so doing, bearing the weight of our sin in his body? And not just yours and mine, and yours and yours and yours. Not just the sins of those of us in this room, but as John would say in 1 John chapter 2, the sins of all the world. How could he do that? It was by entrusting himself to his Father. He wasn't alone on the cross. You see, even though it looked like Jesus had been abandoned by everybody, and certainly all of his friends, all of his disciples, save just a couple and a handful of women, had all fled and left. And there was only a few of his compatriots who were there with him, looking at him as he was hanging on the cross. Besides them, it looked like Jesus had been abandoned by everyone. The world had turned against him. And maybe, and certainly to the bystanders, they assume God has rejected him. I mean, after all, if you are the Son of God, they would taunt, come down from the cross and show us and we'll believe. Right? Let the Lord rescue him. If the Lord delights in him, let him save him. And yet they stood there and looked, and Jesus stayed on the cross. And he breathed his last, and he gave up the spirit, and he died on the cross. And I can almost see some of those jeering bystanders say, "See, told you he was a fraud. God wasn't with him. If God was with him, that wouldn't have happened." But what they fail to realize, and sometimes what we fail to realize, is that though in the moment it may have looked like God had abandoned his Son, God, working behind the scenes in ways that we cannot see with the naked eye, was bringing about and working towards a greater good. Turn with me to John chapter 12. In John chapter 12, Jesus is talking about his upcoming death. And notice he says to his Father in verse 27, John chapter 12 and verse 27, "Now my soul has become troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? But for this purpose I came to this hour." Jesus is saying, I'm getting ready to die. This is on the night that he's betrayed. I'm getting ready to die. Should I ask God to save me from this? This is the whole reason why I came. Was to die for the sins of the world. And so notice what he says. "Father, glorify your name." I'm not going to ask you to not make me go through with it. I'm going to ask that your name will be glorified in what happens. And notice what the Father responds. "I have both glorified it and I will glorify it again." I think that the Father is talking about his death, his triumph ultimately over death, but not just that he's going to die and be raised, but that in his death he's going to conquer sin and pay the price. And that, the salvation that God can then turn and offer to man because of the redemptive sacrifice of Jesus, is the thing that glorifies God and glorifies the Son. And you think, and even his disciples on this occasion are saying, no, the Messiah, the Christ, he's not supposed to die. He's supposed to remain forever. How can you say you're going to die? Because from their perspective, it didn't make sense. How can glory come through death? And yet that's exactly the means that God is going to use to achieve this greater purpose. If you go back one chapter to John chapter 11, the Pharisees are conspiring to get rid of Jesus because they see him as a threat to the Jewish nation. Therefore, verse 47, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council. They were saying, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all. Nor do you take into account that it is expedient for one, or for you, that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish. Now, in Caiaphas' mind, he's thinking, we got to get rid of this guy so that the whole nation of Israel doesn't perish, that the Romans don't come in and take everything away from us. Let's get rid of this one guy so the rest of us will prosper. But what John tells us is that he did not say this on his own initiative. But being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not for the nation of Jews only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. Isn't that interesting? God was going to use the death of Jesus to gather all men to himself. This is why the Hebrew writer would say, trying to encourage us, since we have, verse 1, such a great cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus. And notice how he describes Jesus here, the author and perfecter of faith. What does that mean that he's the author and the perfecter of faith? It's not just that he told us about faith and makes faith possible or something like that. He demonstrated faith when he was going through what he went through. He showed us what real faith in God looks like. And indeed, he is the author and perfecter of faith. If he hadn't have done what he had done, we would not be able to have faith in anything. But notice this, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. How did Jesus endure the cross? No, it wasn't by dwelling on how painful it was going to be. It wasn't by contemplating, you know, how much the weight of the sin of the world was going to be a burden to him. And how excruciating and terrible that was going to be to pay that. No, he looked beyond that to the joy set before him, to what it was going to accomplish. Namely, that he would be able to offer forgiveness to all of the world. And that we would be able to sit with him on the throne of God based on his sacrifice. You see, to everybody's perspective, it looked like God had abandoned Jesus. But God was there. God was working in the circumstances to bring about the greatest good that there ever could be. Maybe in a way that to us seems unconventional or counterintuitive. But I think it illustrates the point that sometimes when it seems like God is nowhere to be found, he's actually right there
trying to accomplish something that we aren't expecting.
So when it seems that God is absent in our lives, when we're going through struggles or hardships or confronted by trials, and maybe we, like David, want to cry out, "Where are you?" There are some promises that we can rest upon. Notice, for example, in 1 Peter chapter 3, and in verse 12, here Peter, quoting from Psalm 34, "For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." It's as if God is up there looking across the earth, searching out for those whose hearts are completely his. And he's looking for them, and he's watching out for them. And when they need help, when they need assistance, he's there for them. It's interesting, you go back and read Psalm 34. We're not going to take the time to do that this morning. But notice particularly verses 19 through 22 when you're reading that psalm. The psalmist makes it clear that even though the Lord is there for the righteous, that doesn't mean the righteous that everything is always smooth sailing for them. Indeed, their afflictions sometimes are many. But even in the midst of affliction, in hardship, the promise from God is, "I'm there with you." In Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 through 6, the Hebrew writer says, "Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, 'I'll never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you,' so that we may confidently say, 'The Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me?'" Sometimes we look for our security, we look for our peace of mind in physical things, in wealth, in riches, a retirement fund, whatever the case may be. And God is saying that's not where security really comes from. Security comes from me. Now again, that doesn't mean that everything in life is going to be smooth sailing or that you're not going to face hardships. But we can rest assured that when trial comes, if we really are seeking the Lord and trying to serve him with our lives, he's not going to abandon us. He's not going to say, "Well, sorry, you're going to have to handle that one on your own, pal. I'll check in with you if you make it through." He says, "I'll be there. I'll hold your hand. I'm not going to abandon you in your time of crisis, in your time of need." In Romans chapter 8, verses 28 through 32, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose." Now again, that doesn't mean that everything's going to work out the way that we would like it to all the time. It doesn't mean hardships are never going to come. In fact, he goes on in this text and he talks about the idea that if God is for us, who could be against us? Right? And we can have confidence because God didn't spare his own son, verse 32, "but delivered him over for us all. How will he not also with him freely give us all things?" Who's going to bring a charge against God's elect? God's the one who justifies. Who's the one who condemns? Jesus is he who died, yes, rather, who is raised, who's at the right hand of God, who also intercedes for us. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? Are any of these hardships going to be able to rip us away from God? No. Jesus promised in John chapter 10, verses 27 through 30, that God holds us in his hand and that no one can snatch us out of the Father's hand. He doesn't abandon his people in their time of need. The real question is, are we his people? God causes all things to work together for good to those who really, truly, genuinely love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. It doesn't mean that bad things won't happen. It doesn't mean that you'll never be confronted with a time in your life when you're like, oh God, where are you? I feel like wave after wave after wave of bad stuff is happening to me. You might actually feel abandoned, but remember these promises. If your heart is His, you will not go through that alone. Perhaps in those moments when we feel like God has left us, and maybe even our friends are saying, man, God's abandoned you, dude. He left you alone on that one. He left you out to dry. Maybe God is working behind the scenes to achieve a greater good. I think about what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1. We'll use this verse to close the lesson. 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 6. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been distressed by various trials. Why are we distressed by various trials? So that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen Him, you love Him. And though you do not see Him now, you believe in Him. You greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. God is using that trial in your life, the thing that makes you want to say, God, where are you? To which God might gently respond, I'm right here, refining you, helping you to become in your faith what you need to be as my child. Did you ever think about that? Where is God in your life? Do you see Him every day? Do you see Him in all of your interactions? Do you see Him working actively? That's great. It's wonderful. To Him be the glory. Praise Him for that. Acknowledge Him in His goodness. But maybe this morning you're sitting here going, I am struggling. And I don't know where God is. Let me assure you, He is not that far from you. If your heart is genuinely set on seeking Him, He's just waiting for you to reach out. As Paul would say, it's as if we would just grope for Him in the darkness. We would be able to find Him. But maybe He's using that trial that you're going through as the very thing to help get your attention focused on Him.